Imagine a computer algorithm, right? One that has literally never spoken to a human being. It just sits on a server, silently crunching occupancy rates and housing data, and then boom.
It dictates the rent for millions of apartments across the country.
Exactly. It drives housing prices up in this perfect invisible synchronization. No smoky back rooms, no CEOs shaking hands to fix prices, just lines of code optimizing for maximum revenue. So is that a crime?
Well, under laws written in 1890 for railroads and oil barons, trying to prosecute an algorithm becomes a monumental legal puzzle. You are basically trying to catch a ghost in the machine.
Welcome to today's deep dive. Okay, let's unpack this. We are looking at the evolution of American antitrust policy.
It's a massive topic.
It really is. We are tracking the sweeping story of how the United States decides who holds too much economic power. We're pulling the thread from the Gilded Age railroad monopolies of the late 19th century straight through the aggressive trust busting of the mid-20th century.
Right, the golden era of enforcement.
Right. Yeah, and then into the intellectual revolution of the 1980s, all the way up to the artificial intelligence battles, and frankly, the highly charged political controversies of June 2026.
And to map out this landscape, we are pulling from a remarkably dense stack of source material today. We have historical congressional archives, academic papers on economic theory like from the Chicago and post-Chicago schools.
Heavy reading.
Ah, very heavy. Plus federal court rulings, Department of Justice, and Federal Trade Commission enforcement records, and investigative journalism covering the latest tech and political developments up to 2026.
So the mission of this deep dive is to show you that antitrust isn't just some dry corporate legal field about, two companies merging.
No, not at all.
It is the fundamental battleground over the structure of the American economy. We want to decode how these seemingly abstract rules governing business behavior directly impact your wallet, your job mobility, and even the stability of democratic institutions.
Because every time you buy a concert ticket or sign a confusing employment contract or just search for something on your phone, you are interacting with the invisible boundaries of antitrust law.
It's everywhere.
It really acts as the operating system of the free market. When the system updates or when it crashes, the entire economy feels the shockwave.
Now, before we jump into the data, a quick but crucial note for you. Our sources today contain politically charged allegations spanning 2024 to 2026.
Right. Very recent stuff.
Yeah, we are looking at claims from multiple political perspectives regarding the Trump administration, corporate lobbying, and highly controversial regulatory settlements. So our job today is to act purely as analytical mirrors.
Exactly.
Neither of us is taking a political side here. We are not endorsing the viewpoints of the politicians, the critics, or the investigative journalists in these sources. We are impartially reporting on the allegations, the lawsuits, and the political actions exactly as they are documented in the source material.
Because understanding those events is essential to grasping the modern antitrust debate. The goal is to analyze the mechanics of the law and the structural shifts in power, avoiding the temptation to adjudicate the underlying political grievances.
Right. We're looking at the engine, not taking a side in the race. So let's wind the clock back to the origin point. To understand the chaos of 2026, we have to look at the late 19th century, the Gilded Age.
A fascinating time.
A period in American history where bigness wasn't just frowned upon, it was viewed as an existential threat to the republic.
You really have to picture the scale of the economic shock happening in the late 1800s. The country was shifting from an agrarian economy of localized, independent operators into an industrialized powerhouse.
Dominated by unprecedented corporate combinations.
Right. They called them trusts. Standard Oil, the American Tobacco Company, the Sugar Trust, and of course, the railroad syndicates.
These weren't just successful companies. They were essentially operating as private, unregulated governments. Like, look at the Granger Movement.
Yes, the Granger Movement is a perfect example.
Our sources highlight this massive political mobilization of farmers in the Midwest and South. If you were a farmer growing wheat in 1880, you were entirely at the mercy of the logistics network.
You had a single railroad line running through your county and a single grain elevator available to store your crop. Those infrastructural choke points possessed total local monopolies.
And they took advantage of it.
Oh, absolutely. They didn't just charge a little extra. They engaged in extreme price discrimination. They would set rates just high enough to siphon off virtually all the profit the farmer generated,
Wow.
leaving the farmer in perpetual debt while the railroad barons amassed staggering wealth.
It's pure extraction. So the Granger Movement forced state legislatures to try and regulate these rates, which ultimately proved that a localized response just wasn't enough.
No, states couldn't handle it alone.
You needed a federal hammer. And that brings us to 1887 with the Interstate Commerce Act. But the real earthquake hits in 1890 with the Sherman Antitrust Act.
The Sherman Act is the foundational text of American competition law. It made it illegal to monopolize, attempt to monopolize, or conspire to restrain trade. But what's fascinating here is the philosophical underpinning of the Sherman Act.
Tell me about that.
Well, the legislators who drafted it, Senator John Sherman and his colleagues, they weren't looking at this through the lens of modern, hyper-efficient econometrics. They weren't just trying to save consumers a few pennies on a gallon of kerosene.
They were looking at it politically.
Deeply politically. The prevailing belief was that if a single private entity controlled all the oil or all the steel or all the rail lines, that entity possessed enough raw leverage to corrupt state legislatures.
Right. They could basically buy the government.
Exactly. They could crush independent businesses at will and essentially overpower democratic institutions. The concentration of economic power was viewed as a direct precursor to the concentration of political power.
So the Sherman Act was designed to protect the independent operator, like the small business owner, the farmer, from being squeezed out of existence by centralized corporate behemoths.
Yes. And you see that exact moral framing in the journalism of the era.
Right. Ida Tarbell.
Exactly. Her famous 1904 expose on Standard Oil, the history of the Standard Oil Company. It wasn't a dry recitation of corporate spreadsheets.
It was a brutal forensic accounting.
It really was. She showed how John D. Rockefeller ruthlessly deployed predatory pricing, secret railroad rebates, and industrial espionage to bankrupt his competitors.
And Tarbell's reporting crystallized the public's abstract fears into directed outrage, which fueled the progressive era's political mandates. This gives rise to President Theodore Roosevelt's reputation as the Trust Buster.
Yeah, the DOJ starts bringing massive cases. The 1904 Northern Securities case is a prime example, where the Supreme Court upheld the breakup of a massive railroad holding company orchestrated by J.P. Morgan.
Psychologically, that must have been massive for the public, proving that the federal government could actually step into the arena and dismantle a titan.
It completely shifted the dynamic.
And then they do it again in 1911, breaking Standard Oil into dozens of smaller companies. But the Sherman Act was structurally reactive, right? It sounds like we were playing a game of Monopoly, but the government's job was to flip the board the second one player bought all the railroads.
That's a great analogy. And that reactive nature left a dangerous gap in the law, because breaking up a fully entrenched monopoly takes years of litigation during which the market is suffering.
Right. The damage is already done.
Exactly. So recognizing this, Congress passed the Clayton Act and established the Federal Trade Commission in 1914. The Clayton Act specifically targeted the mechanics of monopolization.
Like what kind of mechanics?
Things like exclusive dealing, price discrimination, and anti-competitive mergers. They were hoping to stop the consolidation before it resulted in a monopoly.
But corporate lawyers are incredibly resourceful. If the Clayton Act said, you can't buy your competitor's stock, the lawyers just found a workaround.
The infamous asset loophole. The original Clayton Act only prohibited a company from acquiring the stock of a competitor if it would substantially lessen competition.
So what did they do?
Companies simply bought their competitors' physical assets instead. The factories, the patents, the delivery fleets.
Wow. So they just bought the actual stuff instead of the paper.
Exactly. It effectively neutralized the law for decades.
Until mid-century patch. The sources point to the 1950 Seller-Kefauver Act as the moment the government finally closed that loophole, triggering what is arguably the most aggressive era of antitrust enforcement in American history.
The 1950s and 60s represent the structuralist era. The prevailing philosophy, championed heavily by the Warren Court, was that market concentration itself was inherently toxic.
Even just a little bit of concentration.
Yes. If an industry was showing even a slight trend toward concentration, the government viewed it as a mandate to step in and stop it. They prioritized decentralized market structures over almost any other economic consideration.
The cases from this era are astonishing when you look at them through a modern lens. Let's look at Vaughn's Grocery from 1966.
United States v. Vaughn's Grocery Co. is the textbook example of mid-century structuralism. You have the post-WWI economic boom in Los Angeles, and the retail grocery market is rapidly evolving from small corner stores to larger supermarkets.
Right.
Vaughn's, a successful local chain, attempts to merge with Shopping Bag Food Stores, another local chain.
And their combined market share in the Los Angeles area was what, maybe 7.5%?
Barely over 7%, yeah.
Today, companies merge, capture 40% of a market, and regulators barely bat an eye. But in 1966, the Supreme Court blocked this merger.
They did. Justice Hugo Black wrote the majority opinion, and his reasoning was entirely structural. He pointed out that the total number of single-store grocery owners in Los Angeles was dropping rapidly.
So they were trying to save the mom-and-pop shops.
Exactly. Even though Vons and Shopping Bag only commanded a fraction of the total market, the court argued that Congress's intent with the Seller-Kefauver Act was to arrest trends toward concentration in their incipiency.
In their very beginning stages.
Right. They explicitly stated that preserving a market of viable, small, locally owned businesses was the supreme goal, even if a merger might result in some supply chain efficiencies or lower prices for the consumer.
It's the ultimate manifestation of the Gilded Age philosophy. The government's job is to keep the market fragmented, period. But I mean, here is the massive logical friction.
What's that?
If Vons and Shopping Bag merging allows them to build a better centralized warehouse, negotiate better wholesale prices, and ultimately sell milk and bread cheaper to families in Los Angeles, wasn't the Supreme Court essentially punishing efficiency?
That is the big question.
Weren't they forcing consumers to subsidize less efficient corner stores through higher prices?
That underlying friction, the tension between protecting competitors versus protecting consumers, became the catalyst for the most sweeping intellectual revolution in the history of American economic law.
Welcome to the University of Chicago in the 1970s.
The Chicago School of Economics. You had scholars like Robert Bork, Richard Posner, and Aaron Director looking at rulings like Vons Grocery and determining that antitrust law had become fundamentally irrational.
Just totally broken.
Yes. Bork synthesized this critique in his highly influential 1978 book, The Antitrust Paradox.
What was the core paradox Bork identified?
Bork argued that antitrust law was created to promote competition, but courts were utilizing it to protect inefficient competitors from the natural consequences of a competitive market.
Oh, I see. Protecting the competitors instead of the competition itself.
Exactly. Bork asserted that the only legitimate goal of antitrust law should be the maximization of consumer welfare.
Meaning the price tag at the cash register.
Primarily, yes. Price and output. The Chicago School stripped away all the Gilded Age political and moral arguments. They argued that bigness is not inherently dangerous.
So big is not bad anymore.
Right. In fact, if a corporation achieves massive scale because it is highly efficient, if it has superior management, better logistics, or economies of scale, and it uses that efficiency to deliver lower prices to consumers, the government has absolutely no business interfering.
Let them be big.
Exactly. To punish that company simply for being large is to punish the exact behavior a capitalist system is supposed to encourage.
So if a company has enough market share to essentially dictate terms to a supplier or exert massive lobbying pressure on a state legislature, the Chicago School framework says that's outside our jurisdiction. Our only gauge is the price of the product.
Exactly. Antitrust was transformed from a sociological and political crusade into a highly technical, math-driven discipline. Harm was no longer measured by abstract threats to the republic.
It was all numbers.
It was measured by econometrics, supply-demand curves, and models of output efficiency.
And this wasn't just an academic debate staying in university libraries. This framework totally captured the federal judiciary and the regulatory agencies. By the Reagan administration in the 1980s, the consumer welfare standard was the undisputed law of the land.
You see it codified in the Department of Justice's 1982 merger guidelines. These guidelines formalized the use of tools like the Herfindahl-Hirschman Index, or HHI, to mathematically measure market concentration.
Lots of math.
Lots of math. But they also introduced a heavy skepticism toward government intervention.
Because the Chicago School believed in the efficiency defense and self-correcting markets. If a monopoly gets lazy and starts overcharging consumers, the theory says that outsized profit margin will act like a magnet.
Right. It attracts new, leaner competitors who will enter the market and undercut the monopoly.
Therefore, the Chicago School argued that false positives, where the government blocks a beneficial, efficient business practice, are far more damaging to the economy than false negatives, where the government accidentally lets a monopoly form.
Because the market will eventually fix a monopoly. But the market cannot fix an overreaching government injunction.
This philosophical shift changed how courts evaluated cases fundamentally. The sources highlight cases from the 1970s like General Dynamics and GTE Sylvania.
Those rulings systematically dismantled the mid-century structural presumptions. Instead of saying certain market shares or vertical agreements were per se illegal, meaning illegal on their face regardless of context, the courts adopted the rule of reason.
How does the rule of reason actually work mechanically in a courtroom?
It creates a complex burden-shifting framework. The plaintiff, usually the government, first has to prove that a business practice actually harms competition in a specifically defined market.
Okay, step one.
Right. If they manage that, the burden shifts to the defendant company to prove that their action has a pro-competitive justification like lowering costs or improving a product.
And then what?
Finally, the burden shifts back to the government to prove that the company could have achieved those same benefits using a less restrictive alternative.
That sounds incredibly difficult for the government to win. You are asking DOJ lawyers to outmodel corporate economists on hypothetical future efficiencies.
It raised the evidentiary bar dramatically, and that led to decades of relatively permissive merger review and a massive wave of corporate consolidation across almost every sector of the American economy.
I mean, I understand the logic of the Chicago School. If efficiency drives prices down, the consumer wins. But this entire architecture rests on the premise that price is the ultimate signal of market health.
Right.
So if the only metric is cheap prices, what happens when a company offers something for free? How do you measure the harm if there's no price tag? Are we just blind to the monopoly?
That is the zero price paradox. This is the exact blind spot that sparked the modern intellectual rebellion.
Because if I use Google search or I open Facebook or Instagram, my credit card is never charged.
Never.
Under a strict, mathematically rigid application of the consumer welfare standard. These platforms don't look like dangerous monopolies. They look like the most efficient philanthropic organizations on earth.
And this realization catalyzed a massive backlash within legal and economic circles, forming two distinct but overlapping movements, the post-Chicago School and the new Brandeisians.
Okay, let's start with the post-Chicago economists, people like Stephen Salop. They didn't reject the math, they just built better models to prove the Chicago School was overly optimistic about self-correcting markets.
The post-Chicago framework recognized that markets are messy, barriers to entry are incredibly high, and dominant firms engage in strategic, highly sophisticated behavior to lock out competitors without necessarily manipulating consumer prices directly.
So they play dirty behind the scenes.
Exactly. Salop popularized the theory of raising rivals' costs.
Walk me through how a company actually executes that.
Imagine you dominate a specific manufacturing industry, and there's only one major supplier of a crucial raw material. You don't have to lower your own prices to bleed out a new competitor.
Okay, so what do you do?
You simply use your massive scale to sign an exclusive contract with that crucial supplier, or you just buy the supplier outright. Now, your competitor has to source inferior or vastly more expensive materials, destroying their margins and rendering them uncompetitive.
And you haven't touched the consumer price yet.
Not at all, but you've effectively killed the competitive threat.
Well, post-Chicago thinkers also hammered on network effects and switching costs, which are, you know, the lifeblood of the modern digital economy.
A network effect occurs when a product becomes more valuable simply because more people use it. A telephone network is useless if you are the only one on it.
Right.
A social media platform is the same. Once a platform achieves critical mass, the barrier to entry for a competitor becomes nearly insurmountable.
Because everyone is already there.
Right. Even if a competitor builds a functionally superior social app, they can't convince users to switch because all of the users' friends, family, and professional contacts are locked into the incumbent platform.
The switching cost isn't financial, it's social isolation.
Precisely. Post-Chicago economists demonstrated mathematically that these dynamics lead to entrenched monopolies that the market will not naturally correct.
But while the post-Chicago school fought on the battlefield of economic modeling, the new Brandeisian movement wanted to tear up the entire map. They are bringing back the absolute fire and brimstone of the Gilded Age.
The movement draws its name from Louis Brandeis, the early 20th century Supreme Court justice known as the People's Lawyer, who fiercely opposed the curse of bigness.
And who are the modern faces of this?
Modern figures championing this movement include current FTC chair Lina Khan, who rose to prominence with her landmark paper, Amazon's Antitrust Paradox, and Tim Wu, author of The Curse of Bigness.
The new Brandeisians argue that Robert Bork's consumer welfare standard is a fundamental misreading of legislative history. They argue Congress never intended antitrust to just be about cheap goods.
They argue that by hyper-focusing on price, we have ignored all the other vectors where a monopoly extracts value and inflicts structural harm.
Like what?
Well, they point out that monopolies harm workers by depressing wages due to a lack of competing employers. They harm suppliers and small businesses by squeezing their margins through gatekeeper power.
That makes sense.
They stifle long-term innovation by defensively acquiring nascent rivals before they can mature. And, echoing the 1890s, they threaten democracy by amassing wealth and unaccountable power that rivals the state.
Which perfectly addresses the zero price problem.
Mm-hmm.
If I use a digital platform for free, the new Brandeisians argue that I am still paying a heavy price.
You are paying with the degradation of your privacy, the harvesting of your behavioral data, and the monopolization of your attention. But more critically, if we connect this to the bigger picture, the new Brandeisians focus on the platform's role as a gatekeeper.
This is the Amazon paradox Lena Khan wrote about. It's like being in a sprawling, incredible theme park where all the rides are totally free.
Right.
But the park owners lock the exit gates, own all the roads leading out, and charge the independent food vendors a 50% tax just for the privilege of selling you a bottle of water. Sure, the roller coaster cost you nothing, but the underlying economic ecosystem is deeply exploitative.
That structural control allows the platform to extract massive rents from the merchants, developers, and advertisers who have absolutely no choice but to use the platform to reach the consumer.
It's unavoidable.
Yes. And this new Brandeisian thinking didn't stay on the fringes. It was elevated to the highest levels of government. The Biden administration's 2021 executive order explicitly treated competition as a whole of government priority, directing agencies far beyond the DOJ and FTC to scrutinize concentration.
And this culminated in the 2023 merger guidelines, which were a direct repudiation of the Chicago School consensus.
Yeah.
They specifically targeted vertical integration and multi-sided platform dominance.
But the defining struggle of the new Brandeisian era is translating those grand structural theories into actual courtroom victories.
Yeah, that's got to be tough.
It is, because when you walk into federal court, you are arguing before judges who have spent the last 40 years thoroughly trained in the mathematically rigid, price-focused Chicago school framework.
Right. Intellectually, how do you convince a judge to block a merger based on abstract ideas like threats to democracy when the defense lawyer is pointing to a spreadsheet showing consumer prices will drop by 2%?
That exact friction generated the bloodbath of litigation we see in our sources covering the years 2024 to 2026. Regulators finally took the fight directly to the titans of the 21st century, big tech and artificial intelligence.
It is the most aggressive, high-stakes period of monopoly litigation since the DOJ went after Microsoft in the late 90s. Or AT&T in the 70s. Let's break down these battlefronts, starting with the massive victory against Google in April 2025.
This was a watershed moment for the Department of Justice. A federal judge ruled that Google maintained illegal monopolies in the open web digital advertising markets.
Now, it's crucial to understand this wasn't about the search engine consumers use every day.
No, this was about ad tech. The incredibly complex, millisecond-fast, invisible machinery that publishers use to sell ad space and advertisers use to buy it.
The architecture behind every banner ad you see on a news website.
Exactly. The DOJ successfully proved that Google had systematically acquired and locked down the tools on every single side of the transaction. They owned the dominant publisher ad server, the supply side. They owned the dominant advertiser networks, the demand side.
And the exchange in the middle.
Yes. They owned the dominant ad exchange in the middle where the auctions actually took place.
It would be like Goldman Sachs representing the company selling the stock, representing the pension fund buying the stock, and simultaneously owning the New York Stock Exchange itself while setting the rules for how the trades clear.
That conflict of interest allowed Google to allegedly siphon off massive margins from both the publishers trying to fund journalism and the small businesses trying to reach customers.
Wow.
And while the DOJ secured that victory, Google is concurrently fighting massive consumer class action lawsuits over its dominance in search distribution.
But the regulators don't always win. In fact, defining the boundaries of these digital markets can lead to brutal defeats, as the FTC found out with Meta.
The FTC brought a landmark case seeking to force Meta to spin off Instagram and WhatsApp. The core argument was that Meta saw a massive shift toward mobile social networking, realized they couldn't innovate fast enough to beat Instagram, and so they illegally bought the nascent threat to maintain their monopoly.
Which intuitively makes sense to most people.
Mm-hmm.
You look at Meta owning the three largest communication apps on the planet and think, that's a monopoly. but the FTC lost in late 2025.
They lost because the federal judge accepted Meta's defense regarding market definition. In antitrust law, before you can prove a monopoly exists, you have to precisely define the boundaries of the market it supposedly dominates.
Okay, so how did Meta define it?
Meta's lawyers successfully argued, "We are not a monopoly in personal social networking services because that market is too narrowly defined. We compete fiercely for human attention against TikTok, against YouTube, and against Apple's iMessage."
And if the judge agrees that the competitive arena includes TikTok and YouTube, suddenly Meta's overall market share mathematically drops below the threshold of an illegal monopoly.
Exactly. This highlights the inherent difficulty of applying 20th century market definitions to multi-sided digital platforms. A platform connects users, advertisers, and developers. An action that harms an app developer on one side of the platform might actually be used to subsidize a free, highly valued feature for the consumer on the other side.
This brings us to the DOJ's lawsuit against Apple, which completely sidesteps the traditional market share argument and goes straight for the architecture of the hardware.
The DOJ alleged that Apple's tightly closed smartphone ecosystem illegally locks users in and artificially raises switching costs.
The famous walled garden.
Right. They didn't just focus on Apple's share of smartphone sales. They focused on how Apple uses App Store rules, restrictions on third-party digital wallets, and the degradation of cross-platform messaging.
The infamous green bubble effect.
Yes, the green bubbles. They use all that to make it functionally agonizing for a user to leave the iPhone ecosystem for an Android device.
Meanwhile, the FTC took a major swing at Amazon, focusing on how the company's dual role as both a marketplace operator and a retail competitor allows it to squeeze third-party sellers.
Allegedly coercing them into using Amazon's expensive logistics and advertising networks just to remain visible in search results.
But while these titanic cases against legacy Web 2.0 monopolies are grinding through the slow machinery of the federal courts, our 2026 sources show regulators frantically trying to prevent the exact same consolidation from happening in the entirely new frontier of artificial intelligence.
Regulators look at the history of SERP and social media and realize they were 10 years too late. They are terrified of letting an AI monopoly calcify.
We see Senator Elizabeth Warren raising massive alarm bells over NVIDIA, the undisputed king of AI hardware and chips, attempting to acquire a specialized computing infrastructure company called Slurm.
We also see OpenAI, a massive player itself, aggressively urging state attorneys general to probe the actions of Elon Musk's competing AI ventures.
Showing how quickly these new incumbents will try to use regulatory scrutiny against their rival.
Oh, absolutely. But the most fascinating regulatory maneuver in the AI space is the DOJ's crackdown on acquihires.
Explain the mechanics of this, because it's a brilliant corporate loophole.
In traditional antitrust law, under the Hart-Scott-Rodino Act, if a massive tech company wants to buy a smaller competitor for hundreds of millions of dollars, they have to formally notify the DOJ and FTC and wait for a regulatory review.
Standard procedure.
But in the AI space, the real value isn't necessarily in the startup's physical assets. It's in their human talent and their specialized models.
So the tech giant just bypasses the acquisition entirely.
Exactly. Instead of buying the company, the tech giant simply hires the startup's CEO, its top 30 engineers, and licenses its core AI models for a massive fee.
You just hollow it out.
The startup is effectively hollowed out and ceases to be a competitive threat, but because no formal merger occurred, it bypasses the traditional Hart-Scott-Rodino filing thresholds.
That's wild.
By 2025, the DOJ antitrust had explicitly warned the industry, "We see what you are doing. We consider these acquihires to be illegal mergers in disguise, and we will litigate them."
But the absolute wildest part of the AI antitrust landscape isn't about massive acquisitions. It's about pricing. Our sources discuss a DOJ lawsuit against a company called RealPage, which provides property management software for landlords.
And AgriStats, which deals in data for the meatpacking industry. This is the dawn of algorithmic collusion.
Right.
Historically, if the DOJ wanted to prove an illegal price-fixing cartel under the Sherman Act, they needed evidence of a direct conspiracy. They needed emails or wiretaps of executives meeting in a hotel room, explicitly agreeing, "We will all raise the price of chicken by 10% on Tuesday."
You need a human smoking gun.
But what happens when you introduce an algorithmic intermediary? In the RealPage case, the DOJ alleged that competing property managers across the country were feeding their private, highly sensitive, real-time occupancy and pricing data into a third-party software platform.
And the algorithm just does the math.
The RealPage algorithm would process all this aggregated market data and then spit out daily pricing recommendations, telling landlords, to maximize your overall revenue, you should leave these units empty and raise the rent across the board by 8%.
The landlords never spoke to each other. They never signed a cartel agreement. But by delegating their pricing authority to the same algorithm, the market effectively coordinated to eliminate price competition, driving housing costs up simultaneously.
The AgriStats case in the agriculture sector functions on a similar principle. Competitors submit detailed performance metrics to a central data broker.
And they say it's anonymized, right?
Right. The reports are technically anonymized, but the industry is so concentrated that the participants can easily de-anonymize the data, essentially allowing them to monitor each other's output and coordinate supply restrictions without ever directly communicating.
This moves from legal theory to pure computer science. I was reading the 2026 research by Jesse Keppo on the fragility of AI agent collusion.
Yes, brilliant research.
They are modeling environments where reinforcement learning algorithms, AI agents, are deployed by different companies to set prices.
Using mechanisms like Q-learning, these AI agents explore their environment to maximize long-term profit. What Keppo's research explores is whether these independent AI models, operating entirely in a vacuum without any human rules telling them to collude, can learn to tacitly cooperate.
On their own.
Yes. The AI discovers on its own that triggering a price war destroys profit, so it learns to punish competing algorithms that drop prices, eventually stabilizing the market at an artificially high collusive rate.
If algorithms are fixing the price of rent or chicken without humans actively conspiring, how do you even write a law to stop a computer from being too smart at optimizing a revenue curve?
That is the frontier puzzle. Regulators are currently trying to establish precedent that the mere act of sharing competitively sensitive data through a software intermediary with the expectation that competitors are doing the same to stabilize prices is the illegal conspiracy, regardless of whether the algorithm makes the final mathematical decision.
This is a perfect pivot, because while big tech and AI algorithms grab the flashy headlines, the sources reveal that antitrust enforcement is quietly but massively transforming the rules in areas that dictate the physical reality of the listener's daily life.
We have to step away from the server farms and look at the physical economy. Let's start with the live events market. In April 2026, we saw an explosive jury verdict finding that Live Nation and Ticketmaster hold illegal monopolies.
For anyone who has spent the last 5 years trapped in a digital waiting room, watching concert tickets triple in price through dynamic fees, this case is deeply cathartic.
The DOJ and state attorneys general targeted the sheer vertical integration of Live Nation. They didn't just argue that Ticketmaster dominates ticketing.
What else do they own?
They argued that Live Nation acts as the artist's promoter, owns or manages the physical venues, and operates the ticketing platform. This vertical stack creates a terrifying flywheel.
If an independent venue tries to use a competing ticketing service with lower fees, Live Nation can simply refuse to route their massive stable of touring artists to that venue, effectively starving the venue into submission.
Exactly. The jury verdict validated the theory that this structure allows them to extract exorbitant, inescapable fees from the consumer while simultaneously stifling any innovation in the ticketing market.
But antitrust isn't just about what you buy as a consumer. The last few years have seen a massive awakening regarding what you get paid as a worker. Labor antitrust has exploded onto the scene.
This represents a profound expansion of how we view economic power. For decades under the Chicago School, antitrust looked at individuals almost exclusively as consumers.
The goal was cheap products.
Right. Now, enforcers are increasingly looking at individuals as workers and producers.
We see this clearly with the battle over non-compete agreements.
The FTC attempted to implement a sweeping nationwide ban on non-compete clauses, arguing that they are fundamentally anti-competitive because they trap workers in their current jobs, restrict labor mobility, and systematically suppress wages across the economy.
But the structural reality of administrative law hit back hard.
Yes. Federal courts blocked that sweeping administrative rule, ruling the FTC overstepped its statutory authority. And in 2025, our sources note the Trump administration officially dropped the government's defense of the blanket ban.
But that didn't kill labor antitrust. It just shifted the battlefield.
Instead of broad rulemaking, the agency shifted to targeted, brutal litigation. We see the FTC successfully bringing actions against specific companies like the pest control giant Rollins for deploying highly restrictive, coercive non-compete practices.
And we return to AgriStats. They weren't just sued for allegedly coordinating the price of chicken sold to supermarkets. They settled a major lawsuit over poultry worker wage fixing.
This is the concept of monopsony power. Everyone knows a monopoly is when there is only one seller of a good.
Right.
A monopsony is when there is only one dominant buyer in a market, in this case, a buyer of labor. If four massive meatpacking conglomerates control 80% of the industry and they use data to coordinate their compensation packages, they don't have to compete for factory workers.
They can artificially suppress wages industry-wide.
Exactly. And you see this exact monopsony dynamic dismantled in the landmark Supreme Court case, NCAA v. Alstom.
Oh, the college sports case.
For decades, the NCAA used its bylaws to enforce strict amateurism rules, capping the compensation student athletes could receive. The Supreme Court applied a rule of reason analysis and unanimously declared that the NCAA was effectively operating a massive labor cartel,
utilizing its monopsony power over college athletics to illegally restrict the compensation of the workers generating billions of dollars in television revenue.
Yes. And this exact same focus on consolidated middlemen is tearing through the healthcare sector.
Healthcare is huge right now.
Healthcare is arguably the most critical antitrust battleground because of the stakes involved. The FTC released a scathing report regarding pharmacy benefit managers, or PBMs. These are the massive, highly consolidated corporate middlemen who negotiate drug prices between pharmaceutical manufacturers and health insurance plans.
In theory, they exist to pool buying power and negotiate lower prices for the patient.
In theory. But the FTC found that vertical integration, where the PBM is often owned by the same corporate parent as the health insurer and the specialty pharmacy, allows them to construct impenetrable rebate walls.
How does that work?
They steer patients toward more expensive drugs because those drugs generate larger rebates for the PBM, ultimately inflating overall drug prices to generate a staggering $7.3 billion gain for themselves.
That's incredible. We also see the government fiercely scrutinizing hospital mergers, pushing back against the narrative that hospital consolidation improves patient care.
Studies increasingly show it often just leads to higher localized pricing power.
And we see aggressive lawsuits against dialysis giants like DaVita and Fresenius for allegedly utilizing non-poach agreements and market allocation to stifle competition and life-saving treatments.
And this movement extends from the human body to the American farm. We have to discuss the right to repair.
This is a fascinating collision of physical property rights and digital antitrust. The FTC sued John Deere over its repair restrictions.
Modern tractors are no longer just mechanical engines. They are rolling supercomputers running on proprietary software and telematics.
Right.
John Deere instituted digital lock software DRM that prevented a farmer from repairing their own equipment or taking it to an independent mechanic. If a sensor broke, the tractor was digitally bricked until an authorized John Deere technician arrived with the proprietary diagnostic software,
which effectively allowed Deere to completely monopolize the lucrative aftermarket repair market, forcing farmers to endure costly delays during critical harvest windows.
The pressure finally broke them. In April 2026, John Deere agreed to a massive $99 million settlement fund and legally committed to making their diagnostic software, manuals, and tools available to independent shops and farmers.
We saw a similar dynamic in the agricultural chemical sector, where Corteva paid $85 million to settle a class action lawsuit alleging they operated a loyalty program that artificially inflated the price of essential crop pesticides.
It's all connected.
So what does this all mean for the listener? Looking at all of this, from concert tickets to hospital mergers to broken tractors and depressed wages, it feels like we're asking antitrust law to fix every broken part of society.
That's a fair observation.
Is it possible we are overloading this one legal tool with too many social problems?
That is the defining critique of the modern era. Scholars aligned with the Chicago School would argue that by abandoning the strict consumer welfare standard and trying to use antitrust to solve labor disputes, supply chain resilience, and corporate lobbying all at once, you make the law hopelessly unpredictable.
You lose the math.
Right. You replace objective economic modeling with the subjective political whims of whichever administration is in power.
But the new Brandeisians look at that and say, you have it backward.
Exactly. They say all of these disparate social problems, wage stagnation, hyperinflation in housing, broken supply chains, they are all downstream symptoms of the exact same root cause, unchecked corporate consolidation. If you fix the market structure, the symptoms alleviate themselves.
But whether you believe the system is overloaded or finally functioning correctly, our sources point to a much more immediate threat to the system's integrity. By 2024 to 2026, the entire landscape becomes engulfed in allegations that enforcement isn't based on law, but on political loyalty and financial payouts.
The political crossroads.
Yes. This is where I want to pause and firmly reiterate our impartiality disclaimer for the listener. We are about to detail a series of highly controversial actions, investigations, and settlements involving the Trump administration in 2025 and 2026.
Right. These are serious allegations.
Very serious. And to be clear, we are acting as neutral reporters of the historical record provided in our sources. We are detailing the congressional inquiries and the press reports exactly as they occurred, not endorsing the political claims of either side.
Let's set the institutional scene. We enter the Trump 2.0 era spanning 2025 and 2026. A new head of the DOJ Antitrust Division is installed, Stanley Woodward. Now, it is important to note that major legacy cases, particularly in tech and healthcare, did continue. But the broader approach to corporate mergers shifted dramatically.
The sources describe a sudden return to early merger terminations and a much greater willingness to settle complex cases quickly rather than litigating them through the courts.
From the perspective of the business community, this was celebrated as a return to traditional, predictable merger review, ending what they viewed as the hostile anti-business crusade of the Biden years.
But from the perspective of regulatory critics, former DOJ staff, and investigative journalists, this shift was accompanied by a deeply alarming pattern of what they dubbed pay-to-play antitrust. Let's walk through the specific controversies, starting with the media sector: Paramount, Warner Bros., Discovery, and Skydance.
Paramount was actively seeking federal regulatory approval for a massive, highly complex media merger with Skydance. Around the exact same time frame, Paramount agreed to pay $16 million to settle a civil lawsuit with Donald Trump concerning a controversial 60 Minutes interview.
The timing is what caught everyone's attention.
Yes. Shortly after that $16 million settlement was finalized, U.S. regulators cleared the Paramount-Skydance merger. Furthermore, the DOJ later approved the Paramount Warner Bros. Discovery deal without requiring any structural divestitures.
The optics of a massive corporate settlement flowing to the president right as his administration clears a multi-billion dollar merger caused an immediate explosion in Washington.
FCC Chairman Brendan Carr explicitly went on the record stating that the merger approval was based entirely on the merits and was completely unrelated to the civil lawsuit.
But Democratic lawmakers and press freedom advocates accused Paramount of stonewalling congressional probes into whether there was an implicit quid pro quo.
And the controversy deepened when Wired magazine reported that Paramount actively refused to air an advertisement funded by the Freedom of the Press Foundation, an ad that specifically criticized the merger and the company's ties to Trump.
That specific detail ignited fears that media consolidation doesn't just harm economic competition. It allows a consolidated media giant to act as an information gatekeeper, actively suppressing political criticism to protect its regulatory interests.
We see a similar alarm raised regarding the circumvention of career experts in the HPE-Juniper merger.
What happened there?
Hewlett-Packard Enterprise proposed a $14 billion takeover of Juniper Networks. Initially, this was structured as a major DOJ merger challenge, but the DOJ ultimately abruptly settled and allowed the massive deal to proceed.
What makes this a scandal rather than just a standard settlement?
Reports surfaced in investigative outlets like the Wall Street Journal and Semaphore, detailing that lobbyists closely aligned with Trump completely bypassed the career antitrust economists and lawyers at the DOJ, negotiating directly with political appointees.
Bypassing the math.
Exactly. The internal friction was so severe that former DOJ antitrust professionals took the unprecedented step of submitting a formal public comment criticizing the settlement, heavily suggesting the administration had capitulated to political lobbyists over the explicit advice of its own staff.
And didn't someone resign over this?
Yes. This internal chaos culminated in the resignation of the top DOJ antitrust official, Gail Slater, following disputes over these exact major merger decisions.
This pattern of bypassing the traditional legal machinery echoes in the Live Nation monopoly case as well.
Right before the Live Nation trial was set to go to a jury, reports emerged that Live Nation executives were attempting to bypass ordinary DOJ litigation channels, seeking favorable settlement discussions directly with politically connected figures in the administration.
So lawmakers sounded the alarm.
House Democrats held public forums warning that corporate America had learned a new playbook. You don't hire economists to prove your merger is efficient. You hire Trump-aligned lobbyists to avoid a structural breakup altogether.
If you are a CEO trying to buy a competitor in 2026, are you hiring the best antitrust economists to prove your case, or are you just hiring the best lobbyists to get you a meeting at the White House? And we cannot ignore the civil settlements happening with big tech simultaneously.
YouTube agreed to pay $24.5 million to settle a lawsuit regarding the suspension of Trump's account. Meta agreed to pay $25 million to settle a similar lawsuit, with reports indicating much of that money was directed to Trump's presidential library.
And these platforms are writing these massive checks while both Google and Meta are facing existential, company-threatening federal antitrust scrutiny from the exact same administration.
To compound the scrutiny, the Wall Street Journal reported that Meta CEO Mark Zuckerberg actively and personally lobbied Trump in an attempt to avoid or mitigate the looming Meta antitrust trial.
So senators like Ron Wyden and Elizabeth Warren demanded formal investigations into whether these private civil settlements were essentially thinly veiled payments designed to purchase regulatory leniency.
Now, to be absolutely fair to the historical timeline, our sources explicitly note that the major cases against Google and Meta did continue. The DOJ didn't just drop the Google ad tech case after a lobbying meeting. Enforcement didn't vanish entirely.
That is a critical counterbalance. But the institutional danger here isn't just about whether a specific case is dropped.
Right, it's about the law itself.
Antitrust law only functions if the market, the public, and the business community believe the rules apply equally to everyone, grounded in rigorous economic analysis and established legal precedent.
The moment the public perception shifts, the moment enforcement appears to be dictated by political alignment, civil settlements, or hiring the right lobbyist, the fundamental rule of law cracks. It creates a chilling effect on the entire economy.
And because of that perceived unpredictability and politicization at the federal level, our sources document a massive fragmentation of antitrust power.
The rise of the state attorneys general.
Precisely. The federal government does not have a monopoly on antitrust enforcement. State AGs have the authority to sue under federal antitrust law, as well as their own state equivalents, like the Cartwright Act in California.
Because states no longer trust the federal process, viewing it as either politically compromised or overly permissive to corporate consolidation, they are taking matters into their own hands.
We see this vividly with the grocery industry. California, Washington, and Colorado heavily litigating to block the massive Kroger-Albertsons merger, even as federal posture wavers.
The reality of 2026 is that antitrust is no longer a centralized conversation between a CEO and the DOJ. It is a messy, chaotic, overlapping web of state AGs, private class action plaintiffs, and global regulators in Europe all enforcing their own distinct standards.
It makes corporate compliance a nightmare. But from a democratic perspective, it creates a robust, decentralized failsafe against federal capture.
Exactly.
So let's synthesize this incredible century-spanning journey. We started with the moral outrage of the Gilded Age, using the Sherman Act to physically dismantle the railroad and oil trusts.
We shifted into the mid-century structuralist era, where the Supreme Court blocked grocery store mergers just to preserve the fabric of local communities.
Which provoked the massive math-driven Chicago school pivot of the 1980s, fundamentally rewriting the law to dictate that as long as consumer prices are low, massive corporate scale is perfectly acceptable.
And that framework held until the modern post-Chicago and new Brandeisian backlash, driven by the realization that free digital services can harbor incredibly dangerous monopoly power over our data, our innovation, and our political discourse.
Bringing us to the chaotic 21st century battleground. Regulators trying to decode rental algorithms, fixing housing prices. Farmers fighting for the right to repair their own tractors with software patches.
Agencies desperately trying to prevent AI monopolies from forming through acquihires.
And an entire legal system navigating a hyper-politicized era of alleged pay-to-play lobbying scandals. The enduring through line of this entire history is that antitrust is the mechanism a society uses to negotiate power.
Every time you agree to a non-compete clause, every time you search the open web, every time you pick up a prescription, you are interacting with the invisible architecture of antitrust law.
It is the set of rules that determines who gets the right to compete and who gets the power to extract. But here's where it gets really interesting. I want to leave you, the listener, with a final thought to mull over. Something that isn't directly answered in all the court filings and economic models we've explored today. For the last 130 years, from Standard Oil to Google, we have spent all our energy arguing over how to break up monopolies, or how to find them, or how to stop them from merging.
Right, the traditional tools of dismantling power.
Right, but what if the digital monopolies of the future, things like foundational AI neural networks, global social communication platforms, or the underlying cloud infrastructure of the internet itself, What if they're actually impossible to break up without destroying the very utility that makes them valuable? What if breaking up a global communication network just breaks the network?
You're talking about the concept of a natural monopoly for the digital age.
Exactly. Instead of spending the next 100 years trying to smash these titans with the blunt instrument of antitrust law, will the next century force us to abandon the breakup entirely? Will we be forced to recognize them as natural monopolies and treat them like public utilities, strictly regulating their prices, algorithmic transparency, and equal access, exactly the same way the government regulates the water or the electricity running into your home?
Shifting from a paradigm of breaking power to a paradigm of domesticating it. That is the ultimate question for the next era of economic law.
Thank you for joining us on this deep dive. Keep questioning the forces that shape your world, and we'll see you next time.